Hello, everyone, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. Eb Wilkinson and co-host Charles Heller sitting in for Bruce Ash and welcoming you to this week's edition of Inside Track. It's been an interesting week, both in weather and in news. The monsoons are finally here, almost. Well, today they are. We're expecting scattered thunderstorms throughout the day on this rainy August 10th in southern Arizona. We have a great show for you today. In just a few minutes, Vitaly Katzenelson. Vitaly is a CEO and CIO of Investment Management Associates. First, as always, thank you so much for supporting our great Inside Track sponsors, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, and Corazon Cabinets. These are great local businesses you should be doing business with. Let's get to it. Before we hear from Vitaly, let me give you something to consider. Do I feel America is better than other nations? Absolutely. Why do I feel that way? Because we are the only nation in the world that people are dying to get to. Not just emotionally dying, but physically dying. They're coming to America from all over the world. They're not going to Mexico. They're not going to Colombia. They're not going to Canada, unless you're Asian. And they are certainly not going to Canada for their health care. They're coming to America. We are a nation of individuals that told everyone else that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Not the guarantee of happiness, but the pursuit of happiness. This is important. There are those out there, liberals, that feel as though the government should guarantee them happiness. They should guarantee them a job, food, health care, retirement. But those things are the things we're fighting against. King George wanted to control our lives. We wanted the freedom not only to succeed, but also to make mistakes. We are the only nation in the world where we recognize the right by our Creator to protect ourselves. We can keep and bear arms to protect ourselves, not just from bad people, but from the government. When someone takes over the government and stages a coup, and then has the government take over us, we have not only the ability, but the responsibility to take that government back. The Second Amendment guarantees us this right and obligation. In the great movie Starship Troopers, Lieutenant Rastchak asks of his class, what is the difference between a civilian and a citizen? A citizen has the courage to make the safety of the human race their personal responsibility. He has a vested interest in ensuing the continued success of his country, and he will fight, sometimes to the death, to ensure that this takes place. Our forefathers knew this. They knew that when they signed their name to that parchment, they were taking a stand against an unjust and tyrannical government. They pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. 56 men signed their name to a document, changed history, and created a nation. When the President of the United States takes his oath of office, he solemnly swears to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Not foreign or domestic, but foreign and domestic. We have domestic enemies. Just one look at the anti-freedom people prove that. We have foreign enemies. Just one look at Ground Zero, and one look at what the UN is trying to do to us proves that. What more does the UN need to do to prove it? They already have perverted statue of a revolver with a barrel tied in a knot with great reverence in front of the UN building to show us what they think of us and how they view our laws, our history, our way of life. They don't care. They want to get rid of our right to protect ourselves, and we cannot let that happen. Right now, Democratic candidates are in Iowa at the state fair and on television beating the fear and panic drum of gun violence, when what they should be doing is discussing the real cause of the majority of these senseless acts of violence, mental illness. Now, our special guest, Vitaly Katzenelson, because I can't pronounce Smith. Vitaly is the CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Investment Management Associates. He's written two books on investing, which were published by John Wiley & Sons, and have been translated into eight languages. The first book, Active Value Investing, was written for the investment professional in mind. The second book, The Little Book of Sideways Market, is written for the layman. Welcome to Inside Track, Vitaly.
Hi, Butler.
Vitaly, get a little bit closer to your microphone, please.
Okay, how's this?
Sounds great. Vitaly, we're joined here by Charles Heller, Charles.
Hi, Vitaly. My first question for you has more to do with the personal aspect of things and maybe necessarily with investing itself, because Eb is the investment expert. But I want to know something. Your father is an extremely, Noam, I believe, is that how you pronounce his name?
That's right.
Noam is an extremely talented painter. And I wonder, and you're also tremendously interested, as are, I guess are your children too, in classical music. And I wonder how your view of the arts informs, if it does, in any way, your view on investing.
Well, I think to be a good investor, you need to be creative. In other words, if you are kind of very kind of one-dimensional investor, and don't have creativity, then at some point in time, you'll be competing with computers that will be smarter and faster than you are. So I think having creativity, and obviously, you know, there's a lot of creativity in art, is very important. So I feel like, you know, in the long run, my goal is to be kind of multidimensional human being. And that's also going to help me to be a better investor.
That's interesting. Is there any particular thing that you do before considering, like if you're pondering an investment decision for a client or something you recommend, or maybe writing an article, is there anything in particular that you listen to or that you look at that motivates your creativity?
Well, let me tell you one thing I do consistently. Every morning I get up at 5:30 and I write for 2 hours a day. So the only reason I can, you know,
say that, Vitaly, your phone is fritzing a little bit. If you're moving, stop. If you're
okay.
Stationary, move a little.
Okay, I apologize. Yeah, so every day I write for about 2 hours. And while I write, I listen to classical music. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot, I don't know if you remember, maybe 15, 20 years ago, there was a study done that they called it the Mozart effect.
Huh.
That basically, you know, and this is a true story. My wife was pregnant with my son, who is 18 years old now, and I read about the study. And this is like in the infancy of the internet, so I can only read about the study, but I haven't read the study. And the study said that if your kids listen to Mozart, they'll become geniuses. So this is the time. This is before iPhone, and you know, so my wife was literally carrying a belt. She was wearing a belt. They had speakers in it, and it had a CD player attached to it, and she was playing Mozart music nonstop. I actually read the study a few years ago, and the study basically, even though it was called a Mozart effect, the study, the people who did the study, they loved the Mozart, so they used Mozart in the study. They might have been used, if they loved AC/DC, the impact would have been the same. Basically, what happens when you listen to music, your both left brain and right brain get activated at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, when you listen to music, you actually, during that time, you are more creative than when you don't listen to music. So that's it.
Eb?
So that's what I do.
Yeah, we're coming up on our first break, Vitaly. So before I get into some more questions, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Track, sponsored by Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. We're joined with Vitaly Katzenelson. Vitaly, I hope I'm pronouncing that somewhat close.
Hello?
The pronunciation of your name, Katzenelson, are we getting it right?
Yeah, you got it, yeah.
Okay, good.
Hey, Vitaly, we're all driven by different experiences in life. What drives you to be in the investment business?
Well, I think investing, to me, investing is a puzzle. Like, every time I make an investment, Seneca has this saying, time will discover the truth. And so when you make an investment, you basically, I make a bet, like, we do smart research, then you make a bet. And then I'm incredibly curious how it's going to work out. Did I do, I spent a huge amount of research, did analysis, and I want to see, is it going to play out the way I thought it would? And you do this time after time after time. So it's incredibly intellectually stimulating.
So now, when you do that, you're a value investor, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk about value investing. Why is it important that people know the difference between value companies and growth companies?
Could I interrupt for a minute? Would you guys both give me 30 seconds of explanation as to what value investing means as a non-financial person? Would you define it, Vitaly, maybe?
Sure. Well, it's very difficult to do it in 30 seconds. But
well, you can take as long as you need. You're the guest, you know.
Vitaly, you've got another 39 minutes.
All right. So the value investment is basically, I look at it as a philosophy. It's the way you approach analyzing companies or investing. And part of this philosophy, and you can compare it to like where Christianity comes with 10 commandments, I actually wrote an article, actually there's a chapter in my upcoming book called the 6 commandments of value investing.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it's a philosophy where, like commandment number one, you approach investing as if you're buying the whole company, not just a piece of paper. And that is extremely important because stock market offers you this instant liquidity. So you can buy and sell stocks all day long. And it's very easy to become a gambler. But if you approach analyzing companies, if you're buying the whole business, then suddenly you start asking very different questions. How much the business is worth? Do I want to own this business? If the stock market was closed for 10 years, would I want to be in this business? So it's a different. I'm not going to go through all 6 commandments, but the whole point is it's a very different attitude than just like speculation, I guess. So I'll give you one more commandment. Once you figure out what the company is worth, you want to buy it a significant discount to what it's worth, and that's what's called the margin of safety. And the reason you want to do this is because, things happen. Not sometimes good things, sometimes bad things. And if bad things happen, you want to make sure that you're not going to lose money. And when I say this, that doesn't mean that you bought the stock and it went up right away. It, even if the stock price declines, but the value of the firm has not changed, then you're still fine. And which actually brings us to the third commandment, which is basically the true risk is not the price volatility, but the permanent loss of capital. And the permanent loss of capital is when the stock price declines and never comes back. Stock going down in price, actually, a lot of times I celebrate that because now I can buy more shares of the same company, at a lower price.
Vitaly, let me jump in for a second. Permanent loss of capital can also be when somebody gets scared out of the stock ownership and sells it at the exact wrong time.
I agree with you 100%, yes.
Okay, sorry for the interruption. Please keep going. This is interesting.
No, that was it. There are 3 more commandments, but...
Well, you're halfway through. You don't leave us hanging here. We've got 3
no,
more.
No, he yeah, wants you to buy the book, Eb. By the way, Vitaly, give us in the middle of this, give us your website. You've given us a wonderful tease. Tell us where we can get the book.
Well, the book is not out yet, and it's probably going to be out in a few years. But you can listen to the 6 commandments. How about that?
Yeah.
That'd be great.
All 6, perfect. If you go to investor... .fm, like FM radio, investor.fm, the very first episode of the podcast goes through all 6 commandments.
Yeah, FM.
So this way...
Go ahead.
No, I'm good.
It's investor.fm, right?
Yep.
Yeah, FM is a dirty word to us here on AM 1030, but that's okay.
I'll rename the website.
That's okay. We have an FM station too. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So anyway, we're halfway through the 6 commandments. What's number 4?
You need to have a long-term time horizon.
Say that again.
What do you mean by a long-term time horizon?
Well, I'll give you an example. If I only have 6 months, if I need the money in 6 months, I should not be in stocks. Because if the stock price declines, I will not have enough time horizon to wait out for the stock price to recover. So therefore you need to have a time horizon 5 years or longer, hopefully 10 years. Although if you don't have the time horizon, you should not be in stocks, period. You should be in something that an investment asset, an asset that's not very volatile, But I gave you 4 out of 6. So we had, I give you 2/3. How about your listeners?
I'll be happy with 2/3, only if you're willing to come on again at some future date and give us the other two.
Absolutely.
That sounds great. Well, let me go back to my first question, since Charles interrupted me a bit. Thank you. But that's okay. Talk about value investing and why it's important people know the difference between value companies from growth companies. And how would you define a growth company? I mean, we've defined value companies already.
Well, I think here's the thing. I think this difference is very arbitrary. And a lot of times, a value investor can own a growth company. And because I'll give an example. If I own a company and its earnings, I'm fairly certain that over the next 5 years or 10 years, its earnings will go up 5 or 10-fold. And so if I look at the company today and the earnings that I see next year, it may look expensive. But again, if I've done enormous amount of work and I'm very confident that the earnings will be much higher in the future, then this company may be value stock. So the media kind of breaks up companies into value companies and growth companies. And a lot of times we do this by just basically saying, okay, if company trades, let's say it's 15 times earnings or less, it's a value company. And if it's a 15 times earnings and more, then it's a growth company. I see why they do this, but to me, it doesn't really do a good job defining, what volume growth really is. I know that's not what you thought you were going to hear from me, but that's...
So, well, no, I didn't know what I was going to hear from you.
Yeah, so I'll give an example. So in about 6 to 8 years ago, we bought Apple. And, at the auction, I'm going to do something else. 10 years ago, if you looked at Apple traded... I looked at Apple myself then, and it looked very expensive. It was trading like a 30 or 40 times earnings. Apple's earnings from the next 2 or 3 years have doubled. So if you looked at, from where I was 10 years ago, I thought Apple was an expensive stock, and I was wrong. Because actually, Apple price earnings was not 30, or what I thought everybody else thought. It was more like 10 or 8, because earnings went up, a lot. So was Apple a growth company at the time or value company? Well, it's all subject to interpretation, I guess.
So when we're talking about value companies, we're looking at companies that routinely pay dividends.
Yes.
So what are the tangible and intangible benefits that these dividends bring?
When I wrote my first and second book, I kind of professed my love to dividends. And the reason I love dividends because, a couple of things. First of all, it's a source of return, right? When you own a stock, you make money two ways, price going up and collect dividends. So dividends is one of the sources of the returns, number one. Number two, that would be a tangible benefit. The intangible benefit is this. If company has pays out a very large portion of their profit in dividends, that instills a discipline because now a company cannot just focus on producing profit, which is an accounting measure. They have to produce actually free cash flows. So it kind of instills discipline. So this is what I wrote in my book, and this is what I believed then, and I still believe this in this, except what has changed over the last 5 or 7 years that interest rates declined so much that today people that are grasping for any kind of income are buying stocks that pay dividends, and their analysis is very overly simplistic, and I think it'll get them into trouble with some stocks, not all stocks, but some stocks. They look at a company and they say, okay, the 10-year treasury yields 2%, but this company, which looks like a high-quality company, pays me a dividend of 2.5%. Well, this company is not going to go anywhere, so therefore I'm going to buy the company. So, but the problem with that analysis is that it's like you are ignoring if this company is overvalued or not. And a lot of times what happens, these companies, because everybody is doing the very similar analysis, this companies get, you know, their prices, you know, go up and they become overvalued. And there's a lot of companies like this today that are solely focused on paying the dividend, and dividend becomes their product. It's just like it's one of their products. And so what happens, you have investors who at some point interests go up just a little bit, those companies will start acting like a long-term bond, and their stock prices will decline tremendously.
Would Uber be one of those?
I'm sorry?
Would Uber be one of those?
Well, I don't think it pays the dividend, so I...
Oh, okay. I don't follow that closely.
Let me give you an example of a company. So and, I don't know if your show is broadcasted in Texas, but like you know, but I'm probably after this I'll be never allowed to come to Texas ever. So Exxon Mobil, Houston especially. Exxon used to be one of the most cherished and admired companies in the United States. But you know, it's an old company, so at some point it became so successful that it got to the point where it became very large, and it's very difficult to grow for Exxon. Because it's, you know, every time, the problem is oil business, is every time you make a sale, it means that next year, if you want your sales to be just the same, you have to find as much oil as you sold last year. Mm-hmm. Okay, but here's the problem with Exxon. So Exxon, people own today in Exxon because it pays a dividend. I forgot how much the dividend is, but maybe 3.5%. And the problem is the oil prices declined, and Exxon today can barely support a dividend. In fact, if you look at Exxon over the last 10 years, it basically had to borrow money to pay a dividend.
Hmm.
Okay, so at some point, obviously you cannot do this forever, right? At some point, especially if the oil prices stay low, Exxon is going to have to cut its dividend,
right.
and then investors will be shocked.
So just like what happened with GE.
Yes, exactly.
Right. We're up on our bottom of the hour break right now. So, Vitaly, if you'll bear with us for just a little bit, we're going to start our break right now, and we'll be back on Inside Track.
Welcome back to Inside Track, sponsored by Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. We're here with Vitaly Katsanusen.
Katsanelson.
Sorry, Vitaly, I'll just call you Smith. Vitaly Katsanelson. We were talking about ExxonMobil and GE and the fact that they may have to cut their dividends in the future. Is this why you pay so much close attention to free cash flow?
Yes. What I would say is this: when you do research, dividend should be one of the variables in the multivariable equation, but should never be just the variable. So the cash flows, you know, the cash flows would be not variable. I would look how much balance sheet, you know, I would look at the company's balance sheet. I would look at the management. I would look how much stock the management owns. You know, a lot of different factors. But the point I'm trying to stress, because I think this is almost like a public service announcement, when you analyze companies, don't ever just buy a stock just for dividends, because dividends could be manufactured by company for periods of time, like GE did for a while. But at some point, if it's not a real dividend, it's a manufactured dividend, at some point it will be cut, and suddenly you'll find out that the stock price you owned at $35 now is at $10.
Hmm. Interesting.
So now, you were talking earlier about interest rates going down so much that people were going into the equities for the dividends as opposed to the bonds.
Yes.
What's the difference in obligation between bonds and dividend-paying stocks?
That is a great question. So when you analyze bonds, right, the bond is a legal contract. So at the maturity, that you know, like if it's a plain vanilla bond, you're supposed to get your money back. And you'll get your money back if the company is not bankrupt. You know, if the company is an ongoing enterprise, you get your money back. So when you analyze bonds, it becomes a very simple equation, right? Because what the coupons you're going to get over in a certain number of years, and you know how much money you're going to get back. Again, assuming the company is around. Okay, the difference between bonds and stock is that, first of all, the dividends are not guaranteed. But second is that the final price may be very different because there is no guarantee. So if you overpaid, for a stock, if you bought stock at 30, and 10 years from now it trades at five, $10 or $20, guess what? You lost money. And by the way, they, the same thing could happen with bonds, right? If you buy a bond at $130 and at maturity, you get, you're getting $100. Hopefully, you get more coupons than $30 over over life of the bond. So I guess that's but those would be the differences.
Okay.
But Talia, you gave us a tremendous tease in the beginning of the program about the Mozart effect, and your wife went around wearing a belt playing Mozart to your son. If I understand right, your son just turned 18, and he's going off to Israel for sort of a year of in-between and learning and discovery and all that. Did the Mozart effect work on your son?
That's
I'm putting you on the spot here, but...
Yeah, so let's clarify this. So we misunderstood what the Mozart effect is, right?
Uh-huh.
Because we were told if he listens to Mozart, he'll become a genius. My son is a very bright, great kid, right? But the actual study said that the while we listen to music, during the time when you listen to music, it has an impact on you. It helps you to be more creative.
Mm-hmm.
When you stop listening to music, it's basically the effect, the Mozart effect, the music effect stops as well. So,
mm-hmm.
My son loves music. He took some piano lessons. He did not go very far.
Mm-hmm.
But we occasionally go to a classical music concert or to the opera and. But let me put it this way: our interests in music are different. But maybe at some point they'll be more similar. But
so, in other words, the dividend is that he can whistle Rachmaninoff.
He can. Well, this is very important. So when I was growing up, my two older brothers were tortured by my parents to play piano.
Mm-hmm.
And my two older brothers don't play piano, and they one of them likes classical music, one of them doesn't. My parents learned the lesson with me, so they never really forced me to play piano, but they always played classical music, and they always listened to records.
Mm-hmm.
So I listened to a lot of classical music, kind of almost like secondhand smoking kind of thing, kind of secondhand listen. Let's put it this way.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And so the reason it's important is this: because classical music is very difficult music to. It's more complex than pop music.
Right.
So to really fall in love with it, in some pieces you have to listen to them more than once.
Right. Way more than once. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. So I got that listen when I was. I got to listen to them many times when I was 5 or 10 years old, and so when I got older and I listened just to a few times, well, those memories were in my memory bank, so
mm-hmm.
It was easier for me to for classical music to click with me. So that's the only hope I have with my kids. So when they grow up, when they're in maybe the 20s, all the time we listen to classical music in the car is gonna is gonna click with them and. They'll start going to start listening to classical music more. So,
but Vitaly, what is your strange compunction for Russian composers?
Obviously, I grew up in Russia. I was born in Russia and I grew up in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents loved Russian, Rachmaninoff. They loved Tchaikovsky, and so I listened to a lot of these composers a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I know where you're going with that, but somebody asks me, are you American or Russian? Well, so I was born in Russia. I moved to the United States when I was 18 in 1991. So actually, I lived for a longer part of my life in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So in the past, I would say, I'm American. And the reason, the way I would justify it is this. If I cared for sports, which I don't, but if let's say there were two teams playing against each other, like Russian team and American team,
mm-hmm.
I would instantly be on American team's side.
Mm.
Okay, so from that perspective, and yeah, I would be Russian. But I also, have another identity, which is I'm Jewish, and this is, gets a little bit more complicated. But being Jewish is a nationality and religion. Well, when I was growing up in Russia, being Jewish was basically nationality, because in Soviet Russia, religions were outlawed, and so. I only discovered that there is such a religion as Judaism when I was 18 years old. So I also grew up in a very Jewish family. I also have this another identity of being Jewish. And finally, to answer your question about the composers. I really do love Russian composers, and I couldn't figure out why. Then I realized, because when I listen to them, I can remember my childhood. I remember the time I spent with my parents. And so this is why, to me, the Russian composers are so important, just because it's kind of, when you spend like over 90% of your time with your parents, or 95% of your time by the time you are 18 years old, And so, Russian composers basically kind of, remind me of my childhood.
You said in an article, and then we're going to have to take a break, but after this one, you said in an article that your pride in nationality changed after you moved to the U.S. Can you explain that remark that you made in writing?
I don't remember the remark.
That's okay. That's all right. I just want to tell you one thing before we go to the break, and that's that I wish we had it. Our music's already been programmed, but I sure do wish we had that Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, that beginning, so that we could go out on it. But you can hear it in your head when we when we go out. And John, we'll go ahead and take that break on AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero Tucson, The Voice, and we're on Inside Track. We have Vitaly Katsanov Nelson and Eb Wilkinson is hosting, and I'm your co-host, Charles Heller.
Welcome back to Inside Track, sponsored by Tucson Iron Metal Surplus. We're here with Vitaly Katsanov Nelson. Did I get it right, Charles?
You did.
Well, thank God.
But you should ask Vitaly.
Okay. Yes.
He's the expert.
I think you did okay. I mean, this you're getting better every time.
Yeah, I'm working on it. Okay, so let's go back to the finance side. Let's stay with the music side. You talked about your fascination and your love of Russian composers. Your favorite is?
I really can't answer this question, because I think at a different point in my life, I think I love one composer more than the other.
Okay, how about one of your favorites is?
Probably Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky. Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky, kind of.
Okay.
Tchaikovsky probably more favorite now than it was 10 years ago, but
Anything particular by Rachmaninoff that you truly enjoy?
His third piano concerto.
Okay, why is that?
That's the difficulty, right? Because that's the music that clicks with me. It doesn't mean that's his best music, though a lot of people think they do. They think it is. It's just that's the music that clicks with me. And maybe at the time I listened to it, I was in the right emotional state that it clicks with me. And maybe if I listen to it now for the first time, it wouldn't.
Okay.
So I'll give an example. In fact, like Bach, I for a long, long time, I always thought he was boring. And in my 40s, I started to appreciate Bach. So, because maybe now it clicks with my personality or my emotional state.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about the Fed lowering the interest rates. What the heck does that really mean to us as investors? And what does it mean for the equity markets long term? Or, at least in the near term?
So it's basically the Federal Reserve is putting gasoline on the fire. The only problem is when it does that, the gasoline tank, it's using up the gasoline tank, right, basically, because interest rates can go to zero, as we learn, and I guess they can go negative. But if they go negative, that means there's something, very wrong with our economy. I think the Federal Reserve felt like they have to do this, and this is outside my area of expertise. But I think they felt like they had to do this because of the because what happened in China and our trade dispute. So they felt that this may slow down our economy. I don't know. I try to think very little about this because at the end of the day, this is not something I can predict. What's going to happen next? In reality, my time would be spent so much more efficient doing analyzing companies. So I try to spend, is our interest going to be 25 basis points lower? 3 months? I have no idea, and I really try not to think about it.
All right, let's move on to something that you have talked about in the past.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Bitcoin.
You
wrote about Bitcoin back in February 2018. In Kiplinger, and stated that Bitcoin was today's fool's gold.
Yeah.
At the time of your writing, Bitcoin was trading around $10,300.
Yep.
It then plummeted to about $3,200 on December 20th, and now it's back to $11,700. Why is this today's fool's gold?
Well, I think you missed first doubled before it did that. So it's after I wrote it, it doubled, literally, and then it declined.
Okay.
So I'm going to give you a very different explanation than I provided in the past. But think about currencies as being a story. Okay, dollar does not exist it's not something that exists in physics. It's something that people created. And you and I expect when you go to 7-Eleven and we buy gum, and we give them dollars, they're going to give us gum back. Okay, so it's a story. It's a story that everybody bought, that dollar is our currency. And therefore, it's a medium of exchange. So another store is gold. Stop for a second. So the paper currency being accepted by everybody is something that we have brainwashed since we're born. Okay, so 100% of the society accepts that as a story. Then another story that's less accepted is gold. And that's basically maybe I don't know what percent of people think it's a currency, but some people argue that it's been around forever, and currency is debased over time, but gold hasn't. So some people believe that gold is a currency, but it's a small number of people, Then the Bitcoin is kind of like a next iteration, and it's basically another story. But that is less accepted by society. There are certain appeals to Bitcoin, right? Because if I want to send $1 million to you in gold, I would need an armored truck and it's very heavy, right? If I want to send if I want to send $1 million to Bitcoin, I just need it's a very easy thing to do. Okay, so there are certain appeals, especially if you're a millennial and you don't like shiny objects, and you like electronic things. Okay, so the problem I have with Bitcoin, the same problem I have with gold in general, I have no idea what it's worth, and I have no idea if the story will continue. When Bitcoin goes up, declines, if I'm a value investor, so when things decline, usually I should like that, but I only like this when I know that something that was worth $10,000 and declined to $3,000, I get excited about this. But when I don't know what something is worth and it gets cut in half, my knowledge did not increase of knowing what it's worth. So Bitcoin basically is a byproduct. You kind of mentioned the interest rates, right? And, we
right.
talk about interest rates a little bit. Well, Bitcoin is byproduct of central bank policies around the world, right? Because in two-thirds of German bonds today have negative interest rates. So people basically looking for something that will not lose its value when central banks are devaluing global currencies. And so they are kind of reaching out for gold or Bitcoin as possible source of that. And so I understand why they're doing it, but to me as an investor, it's very difficult to own Bitcoin as an investment because for me to own it, I have to be rational. And for me to be rational, I have to know what it's worth, and I have no idea what it's worth.
Is there any way to figure out what it's worth?
Well, not. I mean, not. I've seen theories where, and I forget the numbers now, but let's say the biggest asset of Bitcoin that is scarce, right? There was only so many units that ever can be created. And so I seen the math saying, well, if everybody in the world owns this much of Bitcoin, then it would be worth a lot more, whatever the number is. I also seen the math in the 1990s that when Coke was trading like 80 or 90 times earnings, that where the CEO was saying, well, Americans drink this much Coke, Chinese drink, this much less Coke. If only Chinese and the rest of the world drink as much Coke as Americans did, then Coke would be worth a lot more. Well, that didn't happen, right? So maybe somebody who's smarter than me will figure this out.
If only we could get people to drink Bitcoin.
That's right. Well, but the thing is, when you analyze companies, a lot of times I may say, I don't know, I move on. But let's say you and I were, I was analyzing Microsoft. You and I could have an intellectual debate about Microsoft because we could have an opinion on its cash flows, how much you want to pay for those cash flows. So therefore, you and I could come up with a range of values. And your number may be different from mine, and that's what makes the market. But it would be, somewhere in the same universe. With Bitcoin, it's worth somewhere between 5 and 5 million. And so, to me, it's completely, I can't be rational. Therefore, I'm staying away from it.
Hey, Vitaly, we have 4.5 minutes left. One question I get asked all the time. What are your views on, should we be investing in marijuana stocks?
So marijuana stocks remind me a little bit of a dot-com, kind of, dot-com era. And I'm going to try to simplify it to certain investments. So let's say you can invest into a company that's growing marijuana, right? So to me, marijuana growers are basically just like companies that grow parsley and potatoes and whatever and some other.
Yeah, but they have a component of vodka too.
That's right. Yeah. So the thing is, you don't really know very very many wealthy parsley growers, right? Because it's a commodity. At the end of the day, when you go to the store, you're not looking for a brand of parsley. You're just looking for parsley. So marijuana has a lot of different strains, but at the end of the day, it's a
plant.
It's just a plant. It's just a weed. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And if you invest in growers, you want to make sure that you're owning the one that has the lowest cost structure. Mm-hmm. So, and that's point number one. Point number two. Today, marijuana is legalized. I forget how many states, like 20 or 30 states or something. So you can, if you live in California and you want to bring marijuana to Nevada, where it's legal in both states, you can't because interstate commerce is regulated by federal government, and therefore it's illegal. It's illegal to do this. Therefore, you don't really have that many kind of national brands developed. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to be the money on the recreational side. Will be made in by owning brands. So my analogy would be, I think once marijuana is legalized on a federal level, cigarette companies have a good chance of actually
moving in,
making money. Yeah, yes, because that's what they've done, right? Cigarettes, in many respects, are not much different from that.
So, what about alcohol companies? I mean, for instance, if Stolichnaya developed a marijuana brand, would it be a buy if it was legal?
I think they
have a name.
I think it's arguably, yes. So I think it's closer. At the end of the day, yes. So both cigarette companies and hard liquor companies could succeed in that. I think it's a little bit closer to the cigarette companies. Because it's small, but I can see both of them succeeding in that.
I could just hear the slogans. If it's smoke, it's Stolichnaya. Eb?
Hey, Vitaly, we've got a little over a minute left. Go over once again the website for your six rules.
Yeah. So I have a podcast, which basically, let me explain what it is. It's my articles that are read by somebody who is more pleasant to listen to. And it's the website is investor.fm. Not AM, yeah, but FM, investor.fm.
Investor.fm.
Go to the first episode of the podcast, and you'll get the Six Commandments.
That's great. Vitaly, it's been great having you on. We look forward to talking with you again. It's been a wonderful show. Please support our great sponsors, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management.
Yay.
Tucson Iron and Metal Retail, and Corazon Cabinets. Each one of these great companies are well-run, locally-owned family businesses. All their profits stay here in Tucson to help our community. I know each one of these owners. They love our hometown, and they deserve your support. Until next week for Inside Track, this is Eb Wilkinson.
And Charles Heller.
Good afternoon.